I'll start off by saying this is a work in progress. We're developing a new version of Dasen so we can do these cover crops more realistically. And with that process, there's always kind of like you do the runs and you look at it and you think about it, what's going on. And last week we were doing some runs and we realized that we had to make some coating changes, which we didn't have. Steve's group, Bill Parton over there at CSU, we haven't had time to do it. So the data I'll be presenting today with some of those model runs is the best we have at this point. By this picture, I'm going to be talking about corn stover, cover crops, winter barley, which is we have a new facility out on the East Coast that's making ethanol from winter barley. And that cow's nose comes in play because we're going to talk a little bit about the lignin byproduct from a biorefinery. The cow is like a biorefinery, and the lignin byproduct is like their manure. That's kind of a close example. So that's what the surrogate is there for the cow. So I'm going to be focusing on the use of barley, winter barley, as a double crop in a system to produce ethanol. It's the other starch-based grain ethanol is corn, of course, and this is a new source of starch for ethanol, and they're hoping to qualify for advanced fuel status. They have a pathway, I guess, cleared for them to see if they do qualify. And one of my colleagues did the preliminary life cycle assessment, so I'll be presenting a little bit of that information. We're doing the landscape analysis, the impact of the feedstock, and different land management scenarios on the feedstock footprint. And as I mentioned, the other thing I'm going to mention is discuss is when you harvest corn stover, there's a lot of concern with the impact on soil carbon, and we're evaluating the use of the lignin byproduct to mitigate that impact. So first, as far as our discussion, we've been thinking about the winter barley. We've set up our analysis to try to think about what are the factors that will affect the footprint of the feedstock. There's not a lot of, when you look at the life cycle assessments, really the feedstock is kind of a black box that we don't necessarily think has a lot of impact on the whole life cycle in a sense, or we can't really control the factors that do. I mean, the landscape is very variable, and what do you do about it? Whereas if you have a biorefinery, the biorefinery can be certified, and with the landscape, what do you do? And I'm not really sure, you know, we're going to present the analysis, and I'm not sure what you actually do if some farmer, the way his setup is such that he's going to have a higher footprint than others, you know, what do you do with that? Do you give everybody kind of a general one? I think potentially our preliminary results show that this footprint can be quite significant as far as variation. So in this area, there's what's been on the land. In general, there's kind of a corn-soybean rotation in Virginia where this is. And there's a lot of other cropping systems that are going on there, which I'll say a little bit more about. There's the N application time and rate. Some farmers are doing, some areas are going with two times, once in the fall and once in the spring, sometimes just once in the spring, sometimes twice in the spring, and these are based on observations in the field, which could be hard to model, I guess, in a sense. Precipitation is another factor that can influence nitrous oxide, which is the biggest factor in the footprint of fuels. Our analysis is focusing on yeast, so that's not a big factor there. And then soil texture. The things we're measuring are looking at soil carbon, nitrous oxide emissions, and nitrate leaching from the perspective more of indirect N2O. And then we'll be doing a life cycle assessment. So the black box here is kind of the focus of our area. They're interested, red circle is where their facility is currently located. It came online this summer. They've had some struggles. I think they had a small explosion there that kind of put them offline for a couple months. They're hoping to get back online here again. And it's near Richmond, Virginia. But their area of interest is from southern Pennsylvania Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, North Carolina, and I don't have a black box around this, but Kentucky was another area that they were interested in. Kind of the setup is that in this Virginia area especially, about 50% of the soybean acreage, there's about, if there's 200,000 acres of soybeans in this area, about 100,000 of acres of winter wheat are planted. So they see that there's another 100,000 acres out there that's fallow in the winter where you could be planting barley, so there won't be this competition for land in the case. And anyways, they really can't compete. The wheat is so much more valuable than the barley. On the ground, I guess you kind of wonder, well, why would somebody plant barley then if they can make more money with wheat? And I've been asking myself this question. One kind of practical reason, I guess, and I'm still asking these questions, but one of the kind of practical reasons is that a farmer can only harvest so much wheat. If he can plant barley, it comes off a week or two or three earlier, and it allows him to kind of capture his and use his equipment a little bit better. This is a map of the growing degree days here over the growing season to kind of give you a picture of how we compare to the Corn Belt. And you can see here in the Virginia area, we're kind of like more the low southern Corn Belt here. So we do have the longer growing season here. And up here in Lancaster, it's more like, I guess maybe this is more like the southern Corn Belt there, to give you kind of perspective about our growing seasons. And the reason this is important here is this is an example of the cropping rotation in, I picked kind of the two areas here on the extremes of my boxes here, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where your full season beans, you may get 55 bushels for your full season beans, but your barley harvest comes off a couple weeks later than you would be planting for your full season beans. So the beans after barley may be 46 pounds in this case, and wheat is another week or so longer, so now you're down to 36. So there's this yield penalty on the beans. So actually up here, so barley is a crop up in Pennsylvania. You kind of wonder, well, how can they make it if they're taking this hit on the barley, right? Well, in Lancaster, maybe it's kind of a unique market. Maybe not so unique. We're thinking about how it could apply beyond this area. But straw has a real high value, $150 a ton. So you can get, at a ton and a half, you're talking about some significant money here. And that's what ends up making this cropping system work. Now, if you're down here in Virginia, I have some numbers here. I've been told also kind of some general numbers in the area. Beans after barley is a couple bushels lower, and beans after wheat are 5 to 7 bushels lower. So kind of a wash in a sense here. The season's long enough so that they can grow almost full season beans. And I guess that's why it's kind of the best case scenario for looking at these winter crops and not competing with the crops on either side. As I mentioned, soil texture is a significant factor when you're talking about N2O emissions, and the top graph is percent sand in these counties. This is a dominant soil texture in these counties, and the bottom is percent clay. So up here we can see that a lot of the coastal land here is sandy soils. Sandy loam up here in Pennsylvania, we're more like a silt loam in our Lancaster County there. I am going to present one model run for Richmond County, and that's kind of the classic sandy loam soil there. These are the cropping. We're looking at the change. The kind of the idea is what's the change if we have this practice and then all of a sudden we start growing barley, how is that going to change the footprint of the cropping system out there? It's kind of it's somewhat kind of tricky, I guess, when you start thinking about setting up boundaries on the N2O. So is it on a calendar year? Is it from planting to harvest that you measure the footprint? Actually, you know, really the residual footprint from beans or corn is probably ends up coming off when you have those crops in the field. So it is kind of tricky when you start trying to attribute N2O to a particular crop. But we decide here that our approach would be at this point to have a rotation, the corn-soybean rotation, so like this first one here, this is the corn, winter fallow, soybean, winter fallow. So this is kind of the classic corn-soybean rotation, winter fallow just meaning you don't have anything in the ground. As I mentioned, in this area, about half the soybean acreage has winter wheat on it, so corn, winter wheat, soybean, fallow, not enough time here to grow the winter wheat before the corn's planted. In this area, there's actually a pretty active program in supporting cover crops. So rye is the crop of interest. And I guess they're paying, I think I saw on the website just the other day that they're paying $95 an acre for rye in Maryland right now. So some of our land that we're going into may have planted rye in there, and that's going to impact the carbon footprint. So we did rye after corn, and you get a higher rye yield there after corn than after beans. And then we did rye on both sides. And our assumption here is that the corn and the soybean yields are not impacted by the rye crop. You spray it out before in time to plant your crop as you would normally. And this is kind of the classic cropping scenario they're interested in, with barley following the corn, then beans, and then fallow. There's really not enough time to plant barley there. I've talked with some people down in Virginia Tech and Wade Thomason, and he was mentioning that you end up getting, I think he said that actually one third of the corn actually fails when you plant the barley after the soybeans. So it's pretty risky, I guess. But maybe with these drought-tolerant corn, maybe that will change. The other scenario here that I'm not going to present results on the model, but would be if you could have a rye in it, and that would lead to a higher carbon sequestration. So this region is actually, no-till is pretty common in this area, and this is a map I got from this article here. It kind of, shows where there tends to be a positive response to no-till, a neutral response, and a negative response. And you can see here, we're in an area, in this whole area, where there's a positive response to no-till. And soybeans, I think, is probably 95% no-till, and corn is, 70% no-till. So there's a lot of no-till out there. So tillage will probably have a smaller impact as far as our modeling goes. I mean, there's the way the models are kind of calibrated now based on the data that's out there, you get a significant storage of carbon when you switch over to no-till. But really the idea is you're not going to get a benefit there with the barley just because this would be fallow, right? So that's kind of like no-till. You're not tilling it up in the winter. So we wouldn't expect that really to pertain actually to this particular scenario. As I mentioned, there are different recommendations as far as nitrogen management. It kind of follows state borders in some ways, but there is down in Virginia, they recommend the 3 application time depending on visual observation in the field. And in Maryland, they do some of this also. And so kind of a common, if you were to kind of average over a lot of areas, you put on about 25% in the fall and about 75% in the spring, and either you split that or you don't. But there's interest in not putting it on in the fall because you potentially, these nutrients are potentially more susceptible to leaching. So we are going to be looking at no N in the fall. It's hard to, so a farmer can make this from a visual observation. If he has a lower corn yield in a given year, he would expect that there's more residual nitrogen in that. He could probably go without applying nitrogen in the fall, whereas with the modeling, we either do it or we don't. And as far as the application rate, we do see a range of recommendations or just application rates in the field ranging from about 0.7 to 1.25. So that's the range we're going to be looking at. Although for the simulations I did today, we just went with 1 pound per bushel. So I'll try to make some sense out of these acronyms here. We have, I'll start over here, the CFSF is the corn fallow, soybean fallow. So these are the historic land uses here. So we have the corn fallow, soybean fallow, corn wheat, soybean fallow. And we can see that the nitrous oxide was decreased there. We have the corn rye, soybean fallow, further decreased. And when when the rye is after the soybeans, we get more nitrous oxide. We have a lower yield of rye, so that kind of makes sense. And when you have it on both, then you have your lowest nitrous oxide emissions. On the other side, we did a 30-year simulation here. So it was on this other side. Oops. On this other side, we did 10 years of this historic rotation and then planted the corn, bean, soybean fallow. So this is the change that happened over that time. And we can see here that when you added the barley to the corn soybean rotation, you increase carbon storage, which makes sense. You're adding more carbon inputs to the system now, since you have every other year you're planting barley. So that's kind of the standard that they're looking at. They're most interested in that rotation, and it kind of makes sense that you're going to increase more carbon storage, and that's going to be better for the life cycle there. And you're also reducing nitrous oxide emissions here. And going through these, it's actually easier. What I did here on the next slide is I subtracted these values from here. So this is kind of assuming that these historic rotations are continuing, and if I compare that to current day using the corn, barley, soybean fallow, this is what we see. So this is pretty dramatic. You have quite a reduction in nitrous oxide when the corn, beans, the corn, barley, soybean fallow is changed from the standard corn soybean rotation. And that we can see that depending on the rotation, you get quite a different footprint. And this is expressed on per CO2 per megajoule. So actually gasoline is 96, to kind of put this in context here. So we're getting almost 30, so that's almost, 25-30% reduction in the footprint of the ethanol here with this rotation, versus up here it's going to be more neutral because you're losing a little carbon and you're gaining nitrous oxide. So how this is actually handled out in the field, I'm not really sure, but the preliminary results here point to the idea that this could be quite significant depending on what the farmer is doing out in his field. Nitrate leaching, here again, these first five are all on the corn, barley, soybean fallow, so we don't expect to see much difference. There's a more reduction in nitrate when there isn't any nutrients added to the rye rotation, which is to be expected. Actually, what they're wondering about now is the state of Virginia is wondering whether they can get a credit for planting in the winter barley because you're amending it with nitrogen fertilizer. So are you going to get a reduction, or is it no further benefit from adding the barley in the winter since we're applying nutrients in the winter? So that is a more important question, I guess, that we're looking at. Here is the difference between with and without the fall applied nitrogen. So we can see here that there's a greater reduction in the corn barley than in the others. So my colleagues at Drexel, Sabrina Spitari and her graduate students did a life cycle assessment, and they gathered data. This is a preliminary one. It's based on production information from Virginia Tech. Osage provided engineering data on the plant, which they'll have to verify once their plant gets up and operational, and then GREET for vehicle emissions. And the big thing that makes this work out well is these co-products we have here. We have liquid CO2 here, so they're going to have a plant that's going to utilize the CO2 from fermentation. They have their DDGs, the protein from the barley. They're going to sell that as meal to the industry. They're using the hulls to provide heat for a power plant. And there's the on-site steam co-utilization. And when you put it all together, this is kind of where we're at this point, and it's been somewhat modified here. We're at about 30 grams CO2e per megajoule versus the 96, as we mentioned there. And this is just a quick little bit of information on the lignin here. Comparing corn stover and lignin, there's about three times more N and lignin in the lignin byproduct. And when we ran that through Descent, we'll just focus on the carbon here since we're short on time. Here's when you harvest the stover from the land, you get you decrease the soil carbon. And here we're pretty much maintaining the soil carbon when you're adding the lignin back to the field. And this is the life cycle assessment. We run it through the plant. Sabrina has a student looking at designing a natural gas boiler instead of the lignin boiler. The green bars at the bottom here are biogenic carbon, and that's balanced by the boiler, which has the lignin, the scrubber, which has the ethanol, and then the combustion of the ethanol. And we can see here that with the lignin boiler, you do have a little bit of a higher footprint than when you go with the applying the lignin to the field. Here's a comparison with the natural gas. So in conclusion, application of the biorefinery lignin byproduct to the field may help mitigate this loss of carbon we're seeing in the field. And we're seeing that the land history could have a significant impact on the footprint of ethanol. Thank you.